Hey everyone, welcome back to Wild and Unprotected. I'm your host, Koji Samalde, and here's my co-host, Ethan Lehman.
Hey everyone.
This is going to be a fun, jam-packed episode. I hope you're ready. Let's roll the intro.
Just toss them overboard when you're sitting having lunch, or, you know, just anything.
The classic.
We actually were joking about setting up an OnlyFins account.
Here's to us all swimming through the shit and making more sense of it.
Wild and unprotected. Planet Earth, we can't neglect it. Ah, nature's sexy. We need these plates, so please respect it.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Wild and Unprotected. On today's show, we have a special guest by the name of Denise Peterson. She is the founder and CEO?
Director. Close.
Director of the Utah Mountain Lion Conservation. And you guessed it, it's in Utah. Thank you, Denise, for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course, of course. Well, before we get too far into it, tell the audience about who you are and what you do.
So again, my name is Denise Peterson, and I'm the founder and director of Utah Mountain Lion Conservation, which essentially started as a passion project back in 2017, not long after moving to Utah. And the Reader's Digest version of UMLC is it came about through this need to blend science and education. And so the goal of Utah Mountain Lion Conservation is actually to improve social tolerance of mountain lions in Utah through community, collaboration, education, research. And we rely heavily on trail cameras to help communicate the stories of our wild mountain lions here in the hopes that it helps people better understand them and ergo be more willing to tolerate them in the long run.
Yeah, what's the common perception of mountain lions now, and why was there that need to combine that science and education?
Great question. So what's the first thing you think about when you hear mountain lion? Like, you know, just going off of your exposure through the media, what do you think when you hear mountain lion?
It attacks someone riding a bike.
Big ass cat.
But right, it's typically like something scary with like negative connotation. Like there's this cat that's out on the mountain. It wants to stalk and eat you. It sees people as prey. And honestly, that couldn't be further from the truth. So through Utah Mountain Lion Conservation, we're actually partners on a cougar study. And I've actually tracked big cats and little cats on two different continents now. And I've been up close and personal with close to 20, and I've seen lions, mountain lions, without the use of dogs 12 times. And one of those times really stands out to me, where it was me sitting with the cat for about 3 hours, and she was on a ridgeline as people were just zipping up and down the trail, and they had no idea she was even there. So a lot of our work is just countering that misinformation and those myths about mountain lions. Because if your only exposure to mountain lions is when something bad happens, of course you're going to be afraid of it, right? I kind of equate it to like flying. So flying, most of us know, is safer than driving. Yet the only time we really hear much about airplanes is when like something bad happens, like there's a crash, right? So our brain equates that fear to flying, even though it's safer. So with our trail cameras and through our education program, we want to share mountain lions as they actually are with people and help them understand that, hey, these cats are very literally all around us all the time. And they do a fantastic job of coexisting with us. Like, more often than not, they avoid or just completely ignore us. So that brings me back to some camera trap footage that we got earlier this spring, where I had a male mountain lion during the day sitting at the bottom of a latrine that's literally a stone's throw off the road. And he's sitting there watching and listening. And as you watch the clip, you'll actually see a cyclist go by and then another cyclist go by, and the cat just sits there and does nothing. And then a few minutes later into the video, you actually hear another mountain lion chirping in the background, calling to that cat, and that cat just takes off. So it's that kind of footage that we share with people that helps them realize, okay, so maybe this isn't that really scary, vicious predator that I've been led to believe. Let's talk about what they're actually like.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder kind of what the statistics are of, you know, attacks that are publicized in the media versus encounters that are non-lethal or not even considered an attack, just an encounter. I wonder what the statistic is on that, because I think that would be a good piece of information to convey kind of to the public too, of, you know, hey, you can encounter a mountain lion 99 out of 100 times and never experience anything bad other than you stare at each other and then you go on about your day.
No, that's a really good point. You know, statistics are helpful. But then also understanding, I would say, more their body language and behavior and what it's telling you. So statistically, you're more likely to be killed by your toothbrush or lightning than mountain lion. And in Utah, there's never been a documented fatality by mountain lion since 1890. There have been a handful of attacks, but even then they're rare. So that's why, you know, it's important to just be aware statistically of the risk that they pose to you, which is frankly quite minimal. You're more likely to get hurt driving up to the mountain, like in a crash, than to get hurt by a mountain lion. And that's why it's like, I try to reframe it, not from if you see a mountain lion, you need to automatically be afraid, because you really don't. I've been face to face with a mom and three kittens between me and her. And it wasn't a situation where I'm like, okay, this cat wants to hurt me. It's just like, she's telling me to back off. At no point did she actually really want to attack me. She's just like, give my kitten space. And like with the other cats that we've seen, there's never been a moment where I'm like, I literally feel in jeopardy. And that's why I really like to stress, okay, what is this cat's body language telling you? And if it's not displaying aggression, then you can respond in a different way by maybe taking a picture or just enjoying the moment. And there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't automatically have to be scary.
Yeah. What are some examples of mountain lion body language that you can tell the audience?
So the cool thing about these cats is they're not that dissimilar from like a house cat. So you remember the one cat that I told you I sat with for about 3 hours, and she was on the hillside with the hikers and runners zipping by below her? Well, she was very relaxed, and you could tell by her yawning and just stretching and laying out on a rock. So this is a cat that is completely unconcerned with everything that's going on around her, right? So that was never a moment where I'm like, okay, I have to let people know that there's a cat up here, that they have to be worried. So if a cat's displaying aggression towards you, or if it's actually stalking, one, they're stalking ambush predators, so chances of you seeing them are pretty rare. So if you do see a lion on the trail and it's just kind of glancing at you and then looking away, they're not actually stalking you at that point. Or if it's just walking by, like a camera trapper in California documented, again, it's just a cat moving through the landscape. But if the cat's eyes kind of fixate on you and its ears maybe tucked back and it crouches down and its tail starts twitching, then you might have to worry a little bit.
Okay. Okay. I think those are some pretty good examples. Do they purr like house cats?
Oh my God, yes. We've got some amazing videos of them purring. And they make all sorts of other noises that I think people don't ever think about. Like chirping is one of my favorite ones. And I love playing footage of mountain lions chirping, because every time I play that, inevitably somebody's like, I had no idea they made those sounds. I think I've heard that before. That sounds like a bird. So
we'll have to overlay some of those on the show.
We can do that. And then there's that other famous vocalization, like caterwauling. And that's a
female. What the hell is caterwauling?
Oh, I've got footage of that for you too. So a female will caterwaul when she's looking for love, if you will. And that tells the male that, hey, I'm open for business. So
the shop is open.
Yes, we have footage of that too. So they do all sorts of vocalizations, like even squeaking. It's amazing just to listen to them.
Before we get too far into this week's episode, I wanted to give a quick shout out to our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is you, our listeners. How? Well, now that we're a nonprofit, the donations that we receive go directly towards funding our shows. Want to help or need more information? Visit wildscapeproduction.com/donate to support the show. We're so thankful for the support. You make the show exactly what it is. Man, I need to be careful where I walk in Utah if you got cameras everywhere.
I have a lot of them. I have about 50.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, cats to me, either house cats or big cats, always fascinated me. Growing up, my mom loved cats. And I think that's a good way to kind of backtrack. Before you started your position at UMLC, let's talk about your background, where you got started and how you worked your way up to seeing 20 mountain lions face to face.
That's a great question. So I kind of have a really weird background. Way back when, I went to school for film and video production in Michigan and ended up getting a job on a research vessel, of all things, surveying shipwrecks in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So marine cinematography is a completely different animal than, you know, most types of film. And, you know, it introduced me to the world of research, which I really never saw the path that that would send me on until, you know, now. But when I was living up there, we'd have dispersing mountain lions showing up in Michigan, which sent me down this rabbit hole. I'm like, okay, so there are these big cats that everybody swears to God were overrun with. And I'm like, I'm really not so sure about that. You know, there's only been, I'm going to get the number wrong. Anyway, since 2008, there's been over 20, maybe 30 mountain lion sightings in Michigan, but there's never been a confirmed breeding population in the state. So it led me to thinking, you know, work's kind of dying down on the boat. What can I do next? So I went back to school for wildlife biology, GIS, and natural resources management. And GIS is geographic information systems. It's basically a fancy way of saying mapping. And so I spent most of my undergraduate mapping mountain lion dispersal through the Midwest, using either a least cost path model or a cost weighted distance model to display different potential pathways that they might take trying to get to Michigan. And then doing habitat suitability analyses for Michigan in case they ever did end up setting up shop, if you will, there again. And all of that led me down to Peru, where I worked on a radio-collared felid study down there, studying predator-prey interactions, using basically primate vocalization callback experiments on radio-collared ocelots to see how they would respond. But while I was down there, we had a grid network set up of a bunch of different trail cameras to document the other animals and wild felids on the landscape to kind of figure out how they were sharing the area both spatially and temporally. And that's where I fell in love with trail cameras and really came to appreciate they're used not only for scientific purposes, but also educational purposes to be able to show people animals that they might never otherwise see. So went back to Michigan, finished up school, and realized, hey, I don't want to live in a state that doesn't have mountain lions anymore. So I'm like, I'll take a break. I'll go out to Utah. Let's do some climbing. Let's do some biking. And, you know, just figure out what's next. And fell in love with the state and literally 3 weeks later, picked up everything and moved out here.
Wow, that's a quick turnaround.
Yeah. When you find something that you love, you just go for it.
I think that should be something that we all abide by. Let all that fear go.
Exactly. As far as we know, you only live once. You may as well have fun with it.
I'm coming back as some sort of animal.
What kind of animal?
I don't know yet. I haven't decided. I'm hoping a whale shark. That's my personal favorite animal. I just want to cruise through the ocean.
That'd be pretty incredible.
So let's talk about that background that you have with, you know, videography, and how has that really helped separate you kind of from other conservationists in the space? And what has that done really for you as you formed UMLC?
Yeah, wonderful question. So I think where that maybe differentiates us in terms of what we do is the fact that we rely more on our camera traps than anything. Not just talking about the science behind mountain lions, but talking about them as individuals, right? So actually showing them and getting people interested in them because they can actually see the behaviors. It's not just something that's jotted down on paper, right? Because it's easy to kind of lose people in the literature. And this was something that kind of really struck me coming from a film background, the arts, going into a science program. And I'm just like, you can talk to people about the science and their eyes kind of glaze over, right? But if you hook them with beautiful footage of wild mountain lions behaving completely naturally, I think that it's more powerful than just saying, hey, the stats show this or the science shows this. Instead, it gives them a chance to say, oh, I know, I've not been in those mountains. I've been there. I've never seen a lion. And it facilitates like this dialogue and it gets people more interested in them as an animal. And since we really focus on more than anything showing that footage in our social media and at our presentations, it's generated, I would say, some of the best conversations that I've ever had with people about these cats and opened a lot of minds to them. And I really don't know if we could have done that without that footage.
Yeah, Koji, I'd be interested to see what you think on that.
No, I definitely agree. You hit the nail on the head. It's one thing to try to tell people facts and numbers and scientific jargon, but if you can show them why you care and what you're passionate about, and also just to share the nature, the beauty of nature. I'm a big outdoorsman myself, and I won't go too far into a tangent, but I've seen the natural world around me here in Florida just completely be, you know, destroyed by the hand of, you know, man. And I would love to have seen what it looked like 100 years ago in true 4K quality and just to be immersed in what this land looked like, you know, a century ago, if not 500 centuries ago, you know, and to see and learn more about where I live now. And it's sad, you know, to kind of understand and just face that reality that it will never be how it once was. Mm-hmm. Even today, we can fight really hard to, you know, create, you know, movements to help preserve this, like what we're doing now. But there's a truth behind it that we don't know how much longer we have with our wildscapes and our wildlife. So taking that and capturing it for what it is so powerful. And I think it does connect to a lot of different audiences rather than just people that want to be informed. I think a lot of people can find a lot more to connect with if they can see that beautiful imagery. So I'm right on the same page with you. I do want to know, what was it like filming in Peru?
Oh my goodness.
And did you have this trail camera system in Peru, or were you more of like run and gun with a camera? Like, tell me a little bit more about your technical specs in Peru.
Yeah. So I was basically an intern down there doing a lot of GIS work and tracking the radio collared ocelots using telemetry and doing the playback experiment and then checking all the trail cameras. And so I always had a DSLR with me just in case. And the two times I did see cats down there, one was an ocelot and one was a margay. The margay was zooming down a tree quicker than I could get a camera up. And the ocelot poked her head out at night. And I'm just like, thanks. I can't take a picture of you because it's dark. And so most of my time down there, I was literally wandering around the jungle alone, right? And that comes with sometimes a lot of stigma and fear. Like, okay, something venomous out there is going to kill you, or a jaguar is going to jump out and eat you. But all of my time down there, I spent an entire summer down there. I've never felt concerned, right? And I think a lot of that comes from just understanding your subject and, you know, what they're actually like. And it's one of those places where I'd love to go back someday. And, you know, you can never relive an experience like that, because just, it was one of those really special moments in life where you're helping contribute to the understanding of a species through the science, but also through these cameras to help communicate what's going on with them as individuals. But there was one day down there where I was out, you know, collecting data, checking cameras. They also had me collecting scat, which to this day still excites me way more than it should. And I was out there and it had just rained. And so it was basically the equivalent of fresh tracks on a powder day, right? So I was out there stomping through mud, and all of a sudden I come up on these massive jaguar tracks. I mean, these things were huge. And that was probably one of the coolest moments of my life, which really got me hooked on tracking, because that's one of my favorite things to do. And like, it's been years tracking cats now, and I still just geek out. But I think that was the day that probably really got me hooked on it, because it was just me and this big old cat wandering through the jungle. So I highly recommend going down to South America if anyone ever gets the chance, and, you know, try and get eyes on a wild cat down there, because it's something special.
Is there any specific place that would be kind of your dream place to visit and either track or study big cats?
Only one. Like, everyone has like this laundry list of a bucket list. And so I feel grateful because I've done a lot with my life, right? I've gone a lot of places, done a lot of things, and I don't have anything really much left on that list. Maybe Thailand. But in all reality, I would love to just go down to Patagonia and set up shop and just stay down there for as long as I can and just spend time with the cats down there, because it's becoming more common knowledge, but the pumas down there, and pumas, the same thing as a cougar, which is the same thing as a mountain lion, which is the same thing as a catamount. They call them pumas down there, have gotten used to the tourists and the photographers that come down there to film them. And I've had friends who have actually gone down there and had up close experiences with these cats where they bring this massive lens down with them thinking that they're going to have to shoot something well off in the distance, and the cat literally walks right by them. So if there's not a testament to their willingness to coexist with us, I don't know what else to tell you. But that would be the one thing that I'd want to do, is just go down there and spend time with those cats.
Could you imagine being in like a tent with just the big ass lens protruding? Out of a sudden, everything in the frame gets like super fuzzy.
Yeah.
And you poke your head out and the cat's just like, hi.
They're not even in a tent. They're just sitting out in the open. They're just plunked down a hillside and the cat walks by. It'd be amazing. Like,
just like behind the camera, you poke your head out and the cat's like,
yeah. I can't think of anything cooler than that, honestly. I really can't. But I have a very single track mind. Like, you know, some people have their passions, right? They wake up and they think about football, or they wake up and they think about skiing or snowboarding. Well, every day I wake up, I'm like, I just want to go track cats and check cameras. Like, that's what I love to do. And, you know, so it makes this work easy some days, but it also makes it a lot harder some days too, because Utah is not a great state to be a mountain lion in, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, I could only imagine what it would look like if you were to take all the cats in Utah, because I'm not sure how many are there.
Around 2,000 adults, give or take.
Okay, you have the answer. Of course you have the answer.
I try.
I mean, that is a part of the job.
That is her job, everyone. That's incredible. So 2,000 adults in Utah, and you've studied for how long in Utah? You've tracked, I'm sorry.
2017.
Okay.
Yep, so that's spending a lot of time on the mountain.
Yeah, that's a good bit of time. How much of that time would you say you're alone?
Quite a bit.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. So I don't have an exact percentage. It just depends on if my partner wants to go out in the field that day, or if we have a volunteer who wants to go out and check cameras with us, because sometimes we'll take people out, although we're really not doing that much anymore. And so with 50 cameras on the mountain, it's like you just kind of have to go, right? Mm-hmm. And we're also partners in a cougar study, and sometimes I won't have help available to go in and check a cluster, so I'll go in solo. I'd say greater than 50% of the time I'm out there solo, though. There's only one time I've regretted it. One time in all these years. And that's because I was a bonehead and broke my ankle on the mountain and literally had to crawl a mile and a half off.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So, oops. I have pictures of the cat that I was up there tracking, and I had a pack full of camera equipment, and I was really excited to go set it. But it was the first winter track of the year, and I was geeking out so bad that I had fresh tracks in the snow that I stopped paying attention. And, you know, you get complacent on the mountain for a minute, and it'll get you, right? So I was turning around to come back home, and we were running out of light, and I just stepped wrong, and my ankle went, and I went down. And there was no standing up. I tried bracing myself on trekking poles, and I'm just like, shit. And so I've got pictures of this mountain lion on one of our cell cameras, which is why I knew it was there. And then pictures of me literally dragging my ass off the mountain, going the other way, crawling.
Add insult to injury. You got to watch yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
I wanted to delete those, but that is the only time that I've ever regretted going out on the mountain alone or felt like, okay, maybe this was a bad idea.
Wow. So every other time was one for the books, and then you break your ankle and it's like, oh, well, yeah. Kind of regret that. I know you didn't regret it. You probably loved it the whole way.
You can't have a bad day on the mountain.
That's
even
right.
If you break your ankle. And we've been in some really nasty terrain. So like for the cougar study that we help out on, me and my partner, we've been climbing for a very long time. So we get sent into the really nasty points to go collect data because we have technical climbing experience. And so we'll actually bring climbing gear in. And the steepest day, we had to do 10 rappels to get off the mountain. And so the place where I broke my ankle was ridiculously easy, comparatively speaking. So it was one of those days where you just got complacent and you paid for it.
Mm-hmm. It's like you said, when you get complacent, it'll get you no matter where you are.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's a very interesting story there. I did not expect to get into the wild stuff this early on. It's usually towards the end of the episode. So thank you for batting that one up for us. You make it easy. You make our job easy, Denise.
I try.
Let's go ahead and let's shift gears a little bit and ramp it into the conservation conversation. Had okay. to think about that because it's a tongue twister. And also how that aligns with your vision on collaboration, because we have a few notes here on why it's important to collaborate with everyone. Can you speak on that in terms of what you do now?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, maybe other organizations do this, but this was one that was of the utmost importance to me with Utah Mountain Lion. And, you know, that stemmed from taking a look at how we can be effective in conservation work. And that comes from being able to work with a bunch of different wildlife stakeholder groups, not just people you agree with, because then you're talking to the echo chamber and you don't get any real work done. So with Utah Mountain Lion, we're fully collaborative, and it's not always easy, right? Because like me personally, I could never, ever imagine killing a lion. I don't get it. It's not supported by the science, but we're happy to work with hunters. We're happy to work with houndsmen. I get it. I understand the tradition. I understand the role, the importance of hunting in conservation work over the years. And so it's created this really interesting dynamic with everything that's been going on here in Utah legislatively and in terms of management. And because of our willingness and ability to work with so many different wildlife stakeholder groups, I think that we have the potential to be even more effective in the long run. We were just focused, we were just hit with one of our biggest challenges this past spring. And we did a pretty good job of getting the word out because of those collaborative relationships, because we were willing to work with houndmen, because we were willing to work with sportsmen, because we also work with conservationists and advocates. We were able to get word out about a bill that was introduced that was relatively innocuous otherwise, but language was added to it at the last minute that opened the mountain lions up to year-round hunting and then added trapping to the mix, which nobody wanted. Even the trapper groups didn't want it. And so it snuck in at the very last minute. The public had no chance to comment on it. It was introduced after it was voted on in the House, before it was going to the Senate, after the third reading, and it caught everybody off guard. And because of our relationships with the houndsmen, they brought it to our attention and said, hey, this is what's going on. Let's get the word out. So we worked closely with them and other conservation groups to get the word out. And I gotta say, I'm really surprised and impressed by how many different people picked that up, different groups, different filmmakers, different scientists. It just blew my mind because of the taking that chance to work with the houndsmen. This bill came up, and we were able to hit a whole bunch more people as a result of that relationship. I think that it'll pay off in dividends in the long run and can be a very effective way to run a conservation group. And that's because, and I firmly believe this in my heart of hearts, that when we set aside our differences and focus on the things that we agree on, we can really go get a whole heck of a lot more done. Because, like, especially talking to the houndsmen, we work really closely with the houndsmen through the study, especially listening to them talk about lions and their concern about how they're being managed and their concerns about overhunting and how this new law is going to affect them. They care just as much as a lot of the advocates that we work with too. So it's like, if we combine our efforts, we're going to have a louder voice and we're going to get more done.
I couldn't agree more. We're seeing that as a trending theme with the conservation efforts that we've been talking to and that we've worked with, is that you can't do it alone. It absolutely takes a village. And, you know, sometimes you have to peel back that layer of pride and allow yourself to be open to collaborate with the hunters. That might be something that clashes with you personally or emotionally, but to be able to put that aside and, you know, pull through for the greater good and for the bigger cause, whether that be a longer term, you know, win or a midterm win, whatever it is, working together is going to get you so much further. So I salute you on that. That's amazing. One thing you mentioned is legislation and these laws. Can you kind of, in layman's terms, explain to the audience what legislation issues you're coming up against and kind of what the future looks like?
Sure. So this goes back to January of 2020 when House Bill 125 was introduced and signed into law. This was kind of like that segue into taking the science out of management, it seemed like. And so what 125 did was it mandated the director of the Division of Wildlife Resources to increase predator harvest anytime big game numbers dip below a certain threshold. So basically it's saying, we want more deer, we want more elk, so let's kill more predators. And so a significant portion of Utah is already in predator management. And that is unlimited harvest, and that's not a word I love, unlimited harvest of mountain lions and a bag limit of up to 2 cats per hunter. And so...
Wait, they literally say harvest in the verbiage? What the fuck is that?
They're killing a live sentient animal. There's no two ways about it, especially when you spend time looking at these cats on your cameras and just getting to know them. You're not harvesting an ear of corn. You're killing a living, breathing creature.
Damn, that's cold.
It's very cold. I hate it. But, you know, it's their vernacular, so we go with it for the most part. But a lot of Utah is already in predator management. And so through our partnership, I've got a little bit more insight on what's happening in terms of like deer populations and elk. And after 3 years of that heavy harvest, preliminary data is showing that it's only really helped in one unit, just one. So it's already not helping, right? So in comes HB 469, which is House Bill 469, which is the bill that I referenced earlier on, where that language was added at the very last minute that opens lions up to year-round hunting and trapping. And lions weren't able to be trapped here before now. And it's, again, not supported by pretty much everyone. But it also changed their classification status from a big game species. So instead of having a permit to hunt and kill a mountain lion, anybody who has any kind of hunting license whatsoever can kill a lion if they see it. So they still technically have protections, but they're not technically managed per se. And so this is a huge black eye for Utah, because now we're one of only 2 states that allows trapping of mountain lions. Everyone else doesn't. Texas is the only other one that does, and they're actually moving towards more properly managing their lions. So we're moving backwards. And, you know, it's a real injustice, too, to all of the biologists and the experts that we work with at the Division of Wildlife Resources that have dedicated years of their life to understanding not only mountain lions, but all of the different wild species here in Utah and how they interplay with one another. So to have a couple of representatives just come in and say, hey, this is how you're going to manage them now, and this is what you're going to do, it doesn't look good, frankly. So that was signed into law May 3rd, I believe it was. I should double check that date, but in May. And that was despite outcry from conservation groups, hunting groups, houndsman groups, the trapping groups, Mule Deer Foundation, scientists at Panthera. Basically, everyone is saying, we don't support this. There was this massive outpouring to the governor to veto just that section, just that language. And he still signed it into law. So it's been a pretty rough year so far, put it that way.
Yeah. The optics on that are horrible. And I'm trying to understand why was that even a thing? What caused that language to be used, especially last minute? And it doesn't sound like there was any scientists that backed it or even had passed that on to anyone in the political arena. So where did that come from?
I won't be able to get into that as much as I would like, because there's a lot of politics behind it.
Okay.
Put it that way.
Yeah.
There, a lot of special interest groups come into play. And, you know, there's always the driving concern. We want to grow more deer. We want to grow more deer, right? You hear that all the time. You know, but we need more science that says lions are actually driving the decline in these areas. And we aren't really seeing lions as the limiting factor in many of the units where they're being hit so heavily. It's usually some habitat factor, like, you know, habitat quality or habitat degradation or droughts or really extreme winters like we've had here, or urban expansion. We've got more and more people moving into wildlife habitat every day. Of course, that's going to impact your deer. But mountain lions make a really easy scapegoat, right? It seems like we're doing something if we're killing off something that eats deer. But it's a band-aid to the problem. And we're basically persecuting a species just for eating another animal that we want to eat. And, you know, I grew up on deer. I like venison. I love venison steak. I get it. But at some point, we just have to recognize that lions aren't the problem. We have to take a look at other things like climate change and how that's impacting deer. Or winter range, where people have built and these animals can no longer go. So there's a lot more to it. So it's really more of a political move than anything.
It definitely sounds like it's money driven. And I know a lot of people, you know, tend to shit on Florida, you know, because it's kind of the wild, wild west of what's remaining in the United States. But, you know, I know Florida has a large panther and jaguar population.
There's no jaguars down there.
I thought there were.
No, panthers.
Maybe it's just the fact that they named a football team after a cat.
Yeah.
Damn, Jacksonville. But it does seem like there's also a heavy deer population, and I don't think Florida's ever introduced a anti-panther bill because of deer. Mm-hmm. So to me, if there's any state that would ever make that move, you would think it would be Florida, right?
Yeah.
Florida or Texas. But if Florida hasn't made that move, especially with a lot of, you know, the politics around that, and, you know, if we're being honest, politics is really just money being exchanged with a different name.
Yeah.
So if you want to call a spade, and I'm sure that's, you know, part of what's going down in Utah as well, but we won't dig too deep into that. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of wild to see a state like Florida not enact something like that. But Utah does, and it just be completely, you know, political theater based.
Absolutely. You know, and ever the idealist, I wish politics didn't come into play, but that's not the world that we live in. And so we do the best that we can with the systems that we have in place. And so there's a lot of things going on in the background right now, where we're hoping that we can undo the damage done by this new law before it's too late, before too many animals are killed. But spring is not off to a good start. And I was actually talking to a colleague, and we're already seeing a lot of incidental take from these traps. And we've seen a lot of fawns killed by snares already. So it's just like, we have to be honest. Are we doing more harm than good with this legislation? The goal might be to grow more deer, but if you look at the way this is all starting off, it's just not, it's not looking great.
You know, it's so weird to me, like the goal is to, you know, have a higher deer population, and you're not even focusing on the deer. You're focusing on what's hunting it. And I understand, you know, the easy kind of put together the 2+2 on that one, but why not just focus on the deer and creating, you know, sanctuaries that are constantly, you know, moving through deer, and not just, you know, raising them for slaughter, because I don't think that's necessarily the way to go, but, you know, raising them to be released into the wild in a protected area. Why not just focus on that? You know, if that's the sole problem, why bring an entirely different species in just because you feel like that's going to make a quote unquote impact, especially if the science isn't supporting it? Why not just focus on the one species that you want to increase their numbers on, like we do with every other species that's endangered? Why not go that way instead of, you know, what's hunting it? I mean, we don't, Koji, you got any endangered species off the top of your mind? I'm drawing a blank.
I was just going to say, yeah, it's because someone's pockets are getting lined, bro. Mm-hmm. They're getting money just to be able to say, hey, we're doing good things for the population of deer. And then they're getting paid. So, but politics suck. Everyone sucks in the White House, and we can move on. I think the endangered species that really, well, in terms of conservation, I mean, there's good things being done, obviously, but yeah, there's also shitty things being done, and it sucks. You know, it sucks that we got to sit back on our hands and watch it happen, watch it unfold. So it's stories like this that help us kind of move that agenda forward and allow us to kind of talk to our audience and let them know that, you know, there's humans behind these organizations. We're not just, you know, tree huggers and, you know, robots that love XYZ. We care, you know? So, and to answer your question, Ethan, endangered species right now that are huge in Florida are manatees. And okay, real quick, manatees dying off because of the lack of food. And their number one food source is sea oats and seagrass. And the number one cause for seagrass dying off is the water quality in Florida. And if the water quality isn't addressed, which starts from inland all the way out to the coastal regions, how are we gonna stop seagrass from dying off completely? How are we gonna lose acres and acres in Tampa Bay? How are we gonna lose tons of seagrass down in the Keys and the Everglades and it not be addressed? It's because there's money involved and big agriculture is taking over and has taken over since the 50s and early on. And so, like, it's a huge trickle down effect into the fact that manatees are now at that point where if we don't do something and if we don't provide some sort of, you know, fix to this, not a band-aid, like a true source fix to this, healing the disease, then we may not, our kids may not see manatees. It might just be a myth, you know, it might just be like a walking legend that manatees once came up to the side of your kayak and tried to bite your paddle, and you can kiss that goodbye. And it looks like, you know, from the optics that, oh, Florida, you know, doesn't care. Like, there's a lot going on, like, but it's black and white. It's politics and greed, and it's trickling down into conservation, into wildlife, into wildscapes, into how we run this state. And I think a lot of people are waking up to it. I definitely see a lot of, you know, sharing something on Instagram or social media to your story or whatever, it's not going to really move that forward. It will help people kind of spread information, whether it be true or false, whether it be right or wrong. But I think we are on a verge of people waking up to the fact that, like, oh my God, there actually might be animals in grave danger. Mm-hmm. What can we do? You know, and there's this like running theme that we've run into in previous podcasts where, you know, the term not my backyard really applies. And I'm sure you've heard that too. And I think that it applies in Utah just as much with cats as it does manatees, that, you know, okay, yeah, Ethan and I don't spend time in Utah, nor do we spend time in any of the conservation efforts that we've talked to, but we have a vested interest into knowing that, like, hey, whatever we're doing here with Wildscape could push the needle forward for both organizations. It could bring another door that could swing wide open for both organizations. And whether it be something that's as easy as a donation or a full-on sponsorship, you know, every little bit helps. But that not my backyard term, like, it's so dumb. The earth is our backyard. Yep. We all live here. We all live here. And it's, yeah. So that's my tangent. Endangered species in Florida are really just are at the hands of political power. And it's sad.
Yeah. And why do we always have to wait until the last minute when they are endangered?
Right.
You know, because I hear a lot of people say, well, they're classified as least concern, or there are enough of them, you know, but why do we always have to push that needle so far to the point where, oh, okay, they're endangered. Now let's do something to fix this. Why can't we be more proactive and try and just skip that whole step?
Yeah. Unfortunately, human nature is procrastination.
Pretty much, you know, or maybe lack of foresight. And you see this behavior where they are repeating history over and over again. Because we used to have lions in North America that ranged all the way out east. And then European settlers came in and they saw them as competition or a threat to safety, and they wiped them all out. They almost wiped them out from most of North America, except for the really hard to access places. So it's just like, we seem to be on that path again, right? Montana just decided that they want to reduce mountain lion populations in the state by 40% because they want to grow more deer. And it's just like, we keep doing the same things over and over again. Why? We don't need to. You know, the science doesn't support this. The science says if you kill more mountain lions, you have more conflicts with them. And it completely disrupts their social structure. So all of a sudden you have more younger cats on the landscape competing for resources, ergo eating more deer. So I was like, the science says this doesn't work. Why do we have to do this again? And again, it's that Band-Aid.
Freaking Carol Baskin.
I mean, the people in power just have no fucking clue, you know, what the science actually supports. It seems like, now I'm sure there's some smart people in politics, you know, I'm definitely not completely defacing, you know, politics, but I think there's either no clue or there's a certain thing that's green that will cause a blind eye to be turned. And, you know, it's sad because, like Koji said, at the end of the day, this whole place is all of our backyard. I would not classify myself, you know, as fully eco-minded or a tree hugger by any way, shape or form, but it just doesn't make fucking sense. Like, I think we need to put aside, you know, emotion in a lot of these cases and just use common sense in this particular, you know, arena. Especially when it comes to bringing in politicians and creating legislation, just use common sense. Like, it's not that hard. Like, it's really not, you know, bring in experts, bring in people who this is what they dedicate their life to, look at it objectively and then move the fuck on.
Yeah.
Like there's no reason to overcomplicate this and continue to make things worse because we can't get out of our own way. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. We see it over and over and over again, but I agree. Absolutely. It's just like wildlife is held in the public trust, not for special interest groups or, you know, not just to be discarded as if they have no value. Mountain lions have a very significant value. They keep our entire ecosystems healthy and resilient here. When you start wiping them out, you see this trickle down effect. It doesn't affect just them. All of a sudden, you know, and again, I come from a hunting background and I'm from Michigan where lions used to be, but they were wiped out. And we'll have diseases like chronic wasting or EHD move through and wipe out entire herds. And thinking as a hunter, I want a healthy animal to be able to shoot and eat, you know, and I would think the same thing here. And yet we seem to be on this trajectory where we're like, if we wipe out the predators, we'll have more deer, but we're not really thinking long term. So all of a sudden we'll have more deer, maybe. Because, you know, it doesn't really seem to be working out that way anyway. But let's say that they are successful and we have more deer and all of a sudden you have these herds that are getting sick and just dying off, or too many animals competing for forage and then they're starving to death. And it's just like there's a lot of ripple effects from this action that aren't being factored in that very realistically need to be if you want more deer.
And just like that, she drops the mic. You said it very well. I want to bring this episode back to a lighter note and kind of allude back to some of those wild stories that you were touching base on early on. Can we shift into some crazy experiences that Denise has had in her career? Yeah. I know you've got a whole list of them ready to go, ready to fire off. So
we had a filter for the legislation part of the episode. Let's take that filter and just throw it the fuck away.
Sounds good to me. I could talk cat all day long. And, you know, just thinking in terms of the cats that I've seen, I just want to share a couple of those. I know we already talked about the young female that I sat with for about 3 hours. And I can't talk too much about one of them, but I just want to mention that there was a family of three lions that I got to spend a significant amount of time with, talking about like a couple of months because of the winter that we had here. And I can't talk too much about that, but that was really special. Just seeing those moments with that family group and seeing how they interacted with one another.
I know why we can't talk about it, but oh, I want to so bad.
I know, I do too. I really do, but I just can't. Someday, we'll have to revisit this topic in a year and a half.
Yeah, we definitely have to.
We will.
You know, I think back to the first time I actually saw a lion here in Utah without the use of dogs, because prior to that, I'd seen them with dogs for the study. So we used hounds to treat cats so we can sedate and collar them for the study. And so with the study, we get called in to put trail cameras on fresh kills, knowing that we can document the different interactions and behaviors that were happening there. And so we were going in on this family group of lions, and we knew that they were in the vicinity somewhere, but I wasn't really exactly sure where. It was later in the day. Telemetry wasn't on. So we're just going in and putting up cameras, and I'm like, okay, this is cool. Everything looks good. You know, there's a mule deer here. There's plenty of meat left. We can at least put a couple of cameras on here and see what happens. And so we were coming off the kill. Everything was set up. Beautiful sunset, end of the day. It was like really one of those perfect moments. And so I was solo mid-mountain, and my partner was up on a ridgeline above me. And we were both walking in the same direction towards this draw. And I'm just walking, and all of a sudden I see this tan body just shoot up the hillside. I'm like, holy shit, that's a mountain lion, you know? And I'm like, that's cool. So I radio my partner. I'm like, keep an eye out. I just saw a cat shoot up towards you, you know? Because like for me, like, I don't get that fear response with lions. It's just like, oh, cool, there's a cat. It's not displaying aggression. Take a picture. And so I radio, and I'm like, okay, know that there are at least two other cats in this area. So I'm sitting and waiting. I'm just like, I bet you we'll see another one. That looked like one of the younger cats, which were about a year old at that point. And so I'm waiting, and all of a sudden I see what looks more like mom just slowly sauntering up the draw. And I'm like radioing David. I'm like, I got another cat coming up. And the first one I wasn't able to get a picture of at all. It was moving way too fast. And so I got video of mom just taking her time walking up the hillside, and it was just absolutely surreal. I'm just like, life is amazing. You have this magnificent big ass cat right in front of you. She knows I'm there. Like, I am on the walkie talking to Dave, and I'm like, there's a cat, take a picture. And she knew, and she didn't care. It was just one of those moments where it's just like, you're there, you're on the mountain, you're part of the ecosystem, and you're just enjoying a moment. And I really hope that everyone gets a chance to see a lion in the wild, because it's so damn rare, honestly. Most people never will. Mm-hmm. But if you've been up in the mountains, I guarantee you a cat's seen you. They just have.
Oh, I'm sure. Wow, that's beautiful. And that's when you like least expect it, that you see one. Mm-hmm. I think that's beautiful. Have you had encounters with big cats where you've just not picked up the camera or pulled out your phone and you've just embraced it? I'm sure you have.
Only when they disappear so quickly I can't take a picture.
Otherwise, you're like, I need it.
So, okay, here's where I fall into the cat camp. So we were going in to do another kill site check for another active family group, because we wanted to see how many kittens there were. And so I was leading us in, and this was a long day. It was a really long approach in. And we were cresting the ridge, going up and over, and my partner sees the cat bolt. And I'm just like, shit, I didn't see it. So we get down to the kill, which was not that far away. I think it was like 60 more yards at that point. And he starts pulling, taking his pack off, and I book it. I'm like, I want to see this cat. So I'm running after the cat, which I just,
that sounds like a great idea.
It was really deep snow. She was gone. I'm just like, maybe I can see her, you know? I never saw her, you know, and this is a mom with two kittens. And, you know, it's just a testament to how much they really do try to avoid us. And so that was one of the moments where, like, I didn't break out the camera because she was just gone way too quickly. And most of the times when we've had those fleeting glimpses, it's like, you don't have time to take a picture. Mm-hmm. But even when I was face-to-face with the mom that had the three little kittens, I still broke out the camera to take a quick picture before backing off. But again, I understood her body language and what she was telling me. And it's like, I'm not going to push in closer, but this is too good of an opportunity to not take advantage of. But that comes from years of experience with these cats and understanding their biology and their behavior and what their body language tells you. So for the average Joe, I would say, you know, maybe think and just assess the situation and then decide. But I really like to drive home the point that just because you see a mountain lion doesn't mean that it poses you a threat, right? Just like seeing a deer, or just like seeing a moose, or just like seeing a dog doesn't necessarily...
Or a shark.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that they're there to eat you. Your paths just crossed, you know? And that's why with all wildlife, it's just respect your distance, give them space, give them a room to escape if they need it. You know, don't box them in. And, you know, even if it's a big predator like a lion or a shark, you can definitely still enjoy it. There's nothing wrong with that.
Are there any other borderline stories that you want to tell that might really bring out the laughs or oh my gosh reactions?
I'm trying to think, and like the mom with the three kittens was the only like close call where it's like, okay, there's a cat out there and she's showing me her teeth. The rest of the time is like, you know, just tracking stories, like going out there and scouting new locations, and it's snowing outside and you've got fresh tracks where there's no snow in it, and you're like, oh, that cat's got to be right in front of me. You know, but you still never see him, and that's the way it goes most of the time with these cats. Like, but I think maybe that's why I geek out so much about poop, honestly, because like you're more likely to find their shit in the woods than you are to find them.
Oh. I swear every episode, it always leads back to poop.
That's how you know you're a good tracker.
Uh-huh. Because
it's poop that leads you to the den.
Yep. Or to the latrine or to a good camera site.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like I said, I've been tracking them for years on two continents and I've only seen about 20 and the 12 without dogs. So it's just, it's one of those things where you want more. Like I just, most people are like, I never want to see a lion in the wild. And I'm like, that's all I want to do is see a lion in the wild. Like when I go out on the mountain tonight, when after the cameras get here, I'm going to sit out there with a scope and hope to God I see another lion. Because you never know. It's like you spend enough time out there, you will see one. You just need to know where to look.
Yeah. And we've talked a lot about kind of your trail cam footage. What's the craziest thing you've seen on your trail cam footage? Because I know that's, you know, not only is that important to the science, but also, you know, I'm sure it can provide, you know, some sort of laugh every once in a while or some sort of oh gosh moment. So what's kind of the craziest thing you've seen on the trail cams?
Oh goodness. I did have one male sleep in front of my cameras for about 6 hours. He just zonked out for 6 hours and just laid there. But, you know, thinking in terms of like some of our study cats, they play like little crazy monkeys in the mountains, honestly. And so we had cameras set up on a family group, and the year old kittens at that point in time were like jumping through the trees, and it was just amazing behavior to see. So nothing like too crazy, but just fun interactions that you wouldn't normally get to see.
Yeah. I was just going to try to dig out that one last story, with the white collar, pigs.
Oh, we can talk about that.
I know you totally forgot about the peccaries.
The peccaries? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, non-mountain lion related footage. Oh, let me cover that up. Yeah, non-mountain lion related footage. When I was down in Peru, our trail cameras actually caught a behavior that I was not expecting in any way, shape, or form. And so down there, they have a species of pig called a white-collared peccary. And I didn't see it coming. And again, I don't know much about them. And so I was going through some of the footage after a check one day, and I saw one male pig drop down on his forelimbs, and he started giving oral to another male pig. And I'm just like, okay, that's a thing, you know, and I just never expected that in a million years that they even did that. So life lesson.
When in doubt, watch out for oral.
Exactly. Exactly. Man,
what do they put in the water down there?
For sure.
I have an idea.
Wow. Yeah. Same. Same.
Well, Denise, that's a really good peek into your perspective. Thank you for sharing those stories. I'm sure that someone's going to get a kick out of those. If not just us two, I'm happy with that. Thank you for sharing.
Sure, me too.
Let's shift gears into the future. I know it's unpredictable, but I know you probably have a plan about what UMLC is going to do. Can you kind of touch base on what's next for your organization?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we're hoping to grow a lot in the next few years, right? So we're pretty small. We were a team of three. We're officially a team of four. We just brought on a new social media guy, and I'm really excited about that. But so our reach has been pretty much isolated to Northern Utah, right? And so we really want to grow and expand across all of Utah. And what that entails is ideally getting a team member in every region in the state. So that way we can work on increasing our educational program and talking to more people rather than just folks up here or just on social media, instead giving presentations all across the state. And I'm really looking forward to that growth. And in terms of the Cougar study that we're a part of, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. I know that this new law throws a wrench in a lot of things. And so I don't know what the future of lion research looks like in Utah, but we hope to continue to support it as much as possible. We're also looking to contribute more footage and information to the Division of Wildlife Resources in general, so they can use that for their community outreach and helping support them in any capacity that we can.
Yeah, that's amazing. I know you use a lot of, you know, your videography skills and your trail cam footage as kind of an amplifier for the program. What does that look like in the future, you know, utilizing videography? Do you have any plans in particular for using that trail cam footage or videography in general?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked. So I recently launched my own project that explores beyond mountain lions, because I firmly believe in trail cameras being a powerful tool for conservation. And it's called Explore Wild. So Explore Wild Media. And it's a multifaceted organization that focuses primarily on using trail cameras for conservation. And so we've got cinema quality cameras on hand that we're going to be using to collect footage of not only mountain lions, but of all sorts of other species here in Utah that different organizations can use for their educational or outreach purposes. And we're also renting out this professional camera gear to different groups or individuals that want to use it, or professional companies, because it can sometimes be cost prohibitive to get into some of this equipment. And I understand that that can be a hurdle. And I want companies, organizations, people to feel free to reach out to us and say, hey, I have this project coming up. I need to rent some equipment from you. And we can provide that for them. But we also do one other thing too that I'm really excited about, and that's contract GIS work. So contract mapping work for conservation groups, because that's also near and dear to my heart, because if people can see what's going on with a species or with a region, I think that can be highly impactful, and it's something that I love doing. So we're also doing contract GIS mapping work for different groups that need them through Explore Wild.
That's amazing. And there's such a need for it too. You hit the nail on the head when it comes to how conservation media is very cost prohibitive. I think there's a bunch of talented, you know, videographers and cinematographers out there that would love to get into the conservation space and would have a passion for it, but it is very expensive. And most importantly, I don't think people talk about this enough. It's very difficult on gear. I know this might bring back some sad flashbacks for Koji, but on our first shoot, we didn't even make it through a day without suffering losses to gear. So it's awesome, you know, that you have, you know, that service built in, which was, you know, kind of a direct result from your experience and learning from your experience kind of in the field and what's important and what's not. So that's really cool. And I'm excited to see what you have cooking there.
Yeah, same here. We've got new cameras showing up today, like any minute. And I thought for sure that they'd show up when we were talking. So I've had my ear on the door a little bit. And I can't wait. They're Cambush cameras. They're like so tiny and they fit in the palm of my hand. And they're still professional quality. And I will be hitting the mountain as soon as they get here and getting them up there just to put them to work and, you know, see what we can offer people. And our inventory, I'm planning on that to grow significantly in the next year or two. So that way we've got the resources on hand so we can help out as many people as possible.
That's beautiful.
That's amazing.
Well, I totally support you in getting all the gear that you want and all the tools that you need to be able to tell those stories and capture those animals on film and photo. So yeah, you got two new fans here, of course. And for those that are listening, what's a great way to get contact with you if they have any questions or just need to know more about your organization?
Absolutely. So you can visit our website, utahmountainlion.org. We're on social media, and our social media reach is actually growing quite a bit. Most active on Instagram. So if you look up Utah Mountain Lion Conservation on Instagram, you got us. We just launched TikTok.
That's how we found you.
Yeah. I love Instagram. Like, I used to be Facebook because I'm old. but I recently moved over to Instagram, and oh my God, I'm in love. We are on Twitter, not as active, but Instagram's the way to go. We're on TikTok. We're on Threads now too, because everyone's jumping to Threads.
That died. Threads absolutely took a step off a cliff. I've been looking at the user data on that lately, that Meta releases, and my Lord.
Is it bad?
It's pretty bad.
Oh, wow. See,
I was hoping for it because we jumped on it too. Literally the moment that it released to the public, I made sure that Wildscape had a presence on there. And within 3 days, the user screen time data, which is probably the most important analytic and metric for a social media app, plummeted.
Did it.
And it was pretty interesting. You know, I had high hopes, but it's funny that someone else mentions Threads, on the show.
Yeah. I mean, you look at it and you're just like, you don't see the interactions that you see like on Facebooks and your Twitters. And I'm not a social media expert at all. I know how to track cats and I know how to camera trap. That's my field of expertise. So that's why I brought on a social media person. They can take care of that. So, but yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that. I'll be, because I heard it being called like the Twitter killer or something like that.
Yeah. I always think competition is good. You know, bringing in an additional social media that rivals another only, you know, betters both platforms, essentially. But I think going in with intent to kill, I guess, per se, is never a good thing, you know, especially for consumers, and especially for social media users and content consumers. You know, you want the platforms to be more competitive to each other rather than drive each other into the ground. And I think, unfortunately, and this is just my opinion, Threads' goal wasn't necessarily to create a competitor. It was to drown Twitter out. Okay. And to me, I think Twitter has such an established platform and foundation right now, which, I mean, obviously, without diving too deep into it, a lot of that has changed over the last 6 to 8 months. And I know there's a lot of support and a lot of pushback on that. But, you know, unfortunately, in Threads' case, I think their intent was probably in the wrong place. They released a very subpar, I would say, alpha launch for their product. And it needs a lot of work. I'm hoping over time, you know, it grows and gets to the level of Twitter, because, like I said, competition is always good. And organizations like Wildscape and Utah Mountain Lion Conservation, you know, we only benefit from that because it's more exposure for us. That's what people don't realize with social media. Like, we want a lot of those platforms. We want there to be a larger stage for us to talk about what we're doing. I know social media managers are absolutely cringing right now, and I understand it. Another platform to manage is just horrible. I get it completely. But from, you know, a top-down perspective, from an organizational level, you know, the more exposure we have, the better. So I hope Threads succeeds, and I hope there's other, you know, maybe not TikTok. I'm not TikTok's biggest fan, but, you know, other groups and platforms come to the table and just allow us a broader reach, because that's an amazing thing. The more people we can reach, the more impact that we have. And the more impact that we have, the more animals that potentially are saved. And at the end of the day, that's our goal. And social media is such an amazing and great tool for that. So I'm glad you're on all the platforms, even if one might be dying a little bit right off the launch.
It'll be interesting to see what the future holds for old Threads. But like you're saying, it's more reach, and the more people we can show the animals that we care about or the causes that we care about on, the better.
That's right. That's right. One last thing for the audience. Denise, what's a good way to get involved with your organization apart from social media? And, you know, if someone is in your, you know, 20 mile radius, 50 mile radius, what's a good way that they can come and volunteer or be a part of, you know, helping out with what your organization's doing?
So one of the biggest things that we want to do right now is really grow our events program, right? We've had a pretty small team and we're growing pretty quickly. And so one of the things that we really want to do is start working with more and more communities, especially those that are living along the wildland-urban interface. And so if you live in a community where you hear a mountain lion showing up every once in a while, work with your neighborhoods or your libraries or schools, and let's put together a presentation for that community so we can raise awareness about mountain lions. Like, we get a lot of interest in going out in the field and helping us check cameras, but we're really covered there. Now we really need to work on branching into these areas and talking more about coexistence and how we can live safely alongside these animals, because we can. There are definitely methods in place that help us prevent issues with mountain lions. And that starts by talking with people in communities that live in these areas where mountain lions do pass through, especially like when we have winters like we did last winter, when everything is pushed so far down the mountains that you have mountain lions holding up underneath somebody's deck. So that's the biggest thing that we're asking of people is, like, if you think that there's a need for a presentation in your community, reach out to us and we will make it happen.
Wonderful. You guys heard it here. Thank you, Denise. It's been such an amazing episode diving into the Utah Mountain Lion Conservation.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, guys.
Yeah, we loved having you.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good one. Stay cool.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Wild and Unprotected Podcast, brought to you by Wildscape Productions. Follow us on social media at Wildscape Productions. For more information on our documentary series, Shoreline Stories, visit wildscapeproduction.com. Stay tuned for our future episodes, as we have so much more in store for Wild and Unprotected.